Safety Program with Michael Parker on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Greetings, truth seekers and free thinkers. How's it going? It is Michael Parker coming to you from Los Angeles, California, as always, Monday through Friday. I hope you are well wherever you are on planet Earth. And it is 8:04 in the morning here. It is a beautiful day. And we have a big show for you today. In the first hour, we're going to be joined in just a moment by Dr. Sal Giorgiani. We're going to be talking about this story that I mentioned earlier in the week regarding Biden's demand for the cigarette companies to reduce nicotine. In the second hour, we're going to be joined by Daniel Martinez, who is running for Congress here in California. And then in the third hour, we're going to have the filmmakers behind the brand new Ukrainian film Bad Road, and they're having a premiere of that tonight in Hollywood, and I'm going to be in attendance of that, so looking forward to that. Before we get to the big day ahead of us, I've got one quick story for you guys, and this is something I bring it up because Dr. Sal is joining us from Florida, and this is a Florida story, but it's also something that I've had a keen interest in for a very long time. It's a bit scary, but it's also, you know, it's a real thing, and it's the ecological thing that we are going to have to deal with. I've been following this story since the early 2000s. It has to do with invasive species. So if you don't know, Florida is kind of ground zero for exotic animals exploding in population in the bush. And so they have discovered the heaviest Burmese python ever captured in Florida. It was a female. It weighs 215 pounds. And for our friends and family in Australia, that's 98 kilograms. This thing was nearly 18 feet long. That's 5 meters. It had 122 developing eggs in it. And this was discovered by the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. So around 2005, 2007, I started getting interested in the invasive species story. And this isn't just animals. This is plants as well. In Florida, we've got a whole variety of exotic snakes. There's various theories how this happened. So we've got pythons, we've got Burmese pythons, rock pythons, anacondas, etc. The theory kind of went that during one of the previous hurricanes, I believe it was Andrew or something, that some pet stores got destroyed and these animals were released into the wild. But actually, I think really the truth of it is, it's just people get these animals as pets and think that they're going to take care of these animals. And then they tire of them and they put them into the environment, and the animals do what the animals do. And they find other of their kind and they reproduce. So Florida has a great environment for exotic animals, especially reptiles, because they've also got Komodos. There's a particular lizard which escapes me right now, but Florida is just overridden with these animals. So the python situation in particular is particularly bad because the female python can have so many eggs. So you might ask, Michael, so how in the world do they find these snakes in the Everglades and out in the bush? Well, what they do, it's quite ingenious. They have radio transmitters that they implant onto the male snakes that they call scout snakes. So this particular female was found because they had a transmitter placed on a male snake, and the male snake was called Dionysus, or Dionysius rather, or Dion for short. And they then tracked the male snake because they knew he was up to something. Well, he was looking for a date, and he found this female snake, and that's how they tracked to the female snake. So it's interesting. They captured the snake. And like I say, I mean, if you saw the photo of this snake, it's pretty horrifying. This thing is gigantic, 18 feet long. Like I said, 215 pounds. It is a big, big snake. And I have no animosity to these snakes. They're just, they want to live and coexist like we all do. But this is a major ecological issue because they reproduce so quickly. And there's various accounts of how many animals are being killed throughout the Everglades as a result of this. Because, I mean, these are apex predators. They are at the very top of the food chain. So mammals, they're omnivores, essentially. I mean, mammals, smaller reptiles. I mean, if you're in, but they do eat less frequently than you might think, because sometimes they can go months without eating. But when they do, this particular animal had a deer inside of it. And so, you know, they could squeeze a large mammal, kill it, eat it. They don't have to eat for a while, but they're decimating the animal environment in Florida. So it's an interesting thing. I've followed this for a long time. Of course, a couple of television shows have been dedicated to it. But the idea of invasive species, whether it's animals or plants, is a huge issue throughout the U.S. Some of the Great Lakes and rivers, we have these Chinese carp that have just completely overrun the local fisheries there, in various areas. Well, in New Mexico, we've got these toads. You wouldn't think toads would be in arid areas, but they are. There's various types of plant life that move into certain areas. We had the wild hogs throughout the Southwest. I'm from Texas. I mean, my God, I don't know how many of these wild hogs we have throughout Texas, but they are extremely intelligent. They have several small offspring a year. So the populations of these kind of things explode, and they tilt the table of the local environment. So I just wanted to bring that up to you. It's very interesting. And you know, the animal is just trying to exist. We as humans were the ones who introduced them into the environment. So this is on us. It's not on the python. All right. So this is TNT. This is Deprogram. We'll be back in just a second with Dr. Sal Giorgiani.
Delivering the facts.
Source I can trust.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And this is Dr. Sal's second time to be on the show. We had a great time the first time he was on back in May. And I called him up yesterday because this story that I read, and listen, I know it sounds like I'm picking on Joe Biden, but this one kind of bugged me, this particular story. And the reason essentially, it was reported, I saw this in Yahoo News, but it was originally reported in the Wall Street Journal, that President Joe Biden was going to ask the cigarette industry to reduce the addictive content of nicotine in cigarettes. And I'm not advocating for the use of cigarettes. It just made me think, well, wait a minute, with all the various problems that we have right now, pointing the finger at an industry that's, I mean, the cigarette situation has always been there, but now he's going to demand that this industry reduce nicotine. So of course, the industry is pushing back saying, well, you know, this is going to decimate a lot of jobs and things. But I wanted to get Dr. Sal's opinion on this. And like I say, I just want to make sure you guys understand, I'm not advocating that you go smoke cigarettes. Dr. Sal, good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thanks for having me back on.
Well, I'm glad you're here. And I don't know. I can't hear you that loud. Can we turn up your volume just a little bit, or? That's better.
Well, is that better?
Actually, okay. Better. Maybe it was just proximity to the mic. Yes, I wanted to reach out to you because we've discussed men's health. We're going to talk about that as well. We have quite a bit of time here. You and I, when we were on the phone yesterday, I take this also when I think about opiate addiction, I think about all the various problems that we could be attacking. What do you think about this? Do you think that it is possible to enforce an idea like this within the smoking industry? And do you think it's feasible?
Well, they certainly can do it. It's feasible regulatorily. They can enforce it. In many, many ways, it's not a hard thing to do that. But then when you look at the social dynamics of prohibition, I think we have to be circumspect and learn a little bit from history that, generally speaking, prohibition doesn't work. Look, in 2011, 12, 13, when Michael Bloomberg was mayor of New York, he said that we just sell soft drinks with too much sugar in too large a container. So, and we have an obesity problem and cardiac problems and diabetes problem. So the way to manage that is to reduce the amount of sugar intake in people by not allowing for sugary beverages to be sold in some, you know, in very large sizes. It had to be a limit to how much sugar you could get in any one serving of beverage. So, you know, I don't think that worked very well, because what happened was, it was okay, you know, instead of buying one 16-ounce or one 32-ounce big soda thing, I would get three 12-ounce or four 12-ounce So really, I think what you're going to see is the social dynamic that instead of having four cigarettes a day or half a pack a day, you'll just double it or triple it till you get your required nicotine. Nicotine is addictive. And what does that mean? It's not just the one of the reasons cigarettes are so dangerous is not just the nicotine. That's the addictive part. One of the reasons that they're so dangerous are the carcinogens and the tar that come from burning and inhaling burning tobacco leaves. So hypothetically, I suppose, and maybe in reality, if people need to smoke a pack instead of a half pack or two packs instead of one pack to get their required nicotine levels up, they're going to get twice as much of the carcinogen, twice as much of the nicotine. So twice as much of the tar. So the other things that are significantly more harmful than the nicotine. So rather, I think that's a realistic possibility with this kind of prohibition-like approach.
Well, what you just said is exactly what the cigarette maker said. They're like, well, you know, A, we don't want to do this. We're going to clearly have to, it's clearly would decimate our business. We'd have to lay off a lot of people, but also it's going to have the result that you just mentioned, which is people will smoke more. So it's an interesting thing. And I don't know, to me, it just rubbed me wrong. We have a lot of problems right now. High inflation, fuel costs. We got a war in Ukraine. We got problems on the border. So to me, this just felt like pointing the finger at something, to making a proclamation. You guys go fix that. And but it also, what I was thinking about is like, well, wait a minute. But like, what about opiates? What about drugs that are also killing people? And listen, I'm not going to put you on the spot. But I mean, I have a problem with the emergency use of these vaccines. You guys are telling me I can put that in my kid. There's just all kinds of issues surrounding this. If it's all about the public health, well, then we're fighting that. We've got many different areas that we could fight that war on.
Yeah, there's lots. We have seen a dramatic decline in cigarette use over the decades since I was a young guy with curly hair because of education. Because of constantly warning people, by informing them, by motivating them to not smoke. When you look at it, I was fascinated looking at some of the statistics that in the 1940s and 50s, 45%, it's an amazing number, about 45% of the American public were regular cigarette smokers. Then when you move into the 1980s, it got a little bit better, which is about 30 or so. And then after the tobacco litigation and the push to do education, outreach, go to the kids and tell them how dangerous it is, talk to the parents about how they want to set better examples for their children, et cetera, et cetera. So education now has brought it down in the 1990s to about 30%. And 2010 looks like it's about 25% or so. And now today, it's down to an estimated 12% of the population smokes cigarettes. So you've seen a huge sea change through education, proper communications, good standardized public health messaging, and then local initiatives, very important. And then physicians, nurse practitioners, pharmacists, you name it, anybody in healthcare, counseling patients on the dangers of this. That, I think, is a much more enlightened approach.
That is a phenomenal improvement, I think.
It is. And it just goes to show the power of helping people make up their own minds rather than forcing them into a paradigm that doesn't, you know, one size just doesn't fit all. That it's really, and as with most everything in life, Michael, people who are internalize the message and internalize the habit are the ones who are likely to stick with it as opposed to individuals who have it forced on them, whether we're talking about cigarette smoking, whether we're talking about exercise, whether we're talking about managing diabetes, whether we're talking about vaccinations. When people internalize the messages, it becomes relevant to their life and welfare and those are their loved ones, then they take it up and they do it. And they do it for a lifetime. And it lasts a very long time.
Well, and yes, and as you mentioned before, you can't really, prohibition didn't work. And there are some people, it's just in their character, like, well, wait a minute, you told me not to do that, so I'm going to do more of it. It says here, I was looking at the CDC, it said that cigarette smoking is responsible for 480,000 deaths a year in the country. And that's, you know, that's awful. Some 13.7% of all U.S. adults and are current cigarette smokers, according to the CDC. But then you also take this into account, like you look at drug overdose deaths, fentanyl, opiates, all these. I mean, we had 100,000, over 100,000 drug overdose deaths in 2021. That was up 28.5% over the year before. So we've got another issue. And I mean, this one is increasing at a far faster rate than the use of the use of cigarettes is declining, while it appears the use of these types of very dangerous drugs is increasing. And I don't know, I just think that our efforts should probably be put there, because a person who's hell bent on smoking, they're going to smoke. And you're going to reach a lot of people, and we have already reached a lot of people. And you mentioned that we've gone from 45% down to 12 or 13% just through education. And smoking to a lot of people is not cool. And that's a good thing. We've made people aware of the downsides of it. And most people know somebody in their personal life that succumbed to it. So, you know, the evidence is out there and pretty strong, and most reasonable people. And plus, I mean, you can't go most restaurants. I don't know how it is in Florida, but out here in California, especially in Los Angeles, you know, you can't smoke in restaurants and clubs. And so just normal common sense applications of a demonstration of the health effects of cigarette smoking has been effective enough. Meanwhile, we got these skyrocketing deaths to illegal drugs, opiates, et cetera.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I'll also quip that the most uncommon commodity is common sense. In Florida, it was one of the first states to implement a no public space smoking regulations, and it's been effective. Of course, it's been effective. Yeah. Over to the opiates and drugs of abuse. I think I do agree that that is a significant problem. It's terribly out of control, and it is controllable. And the same sorts of things of persuading people that it's not in their best interest to use these drugs of abuse, that it has many, many effects, and not just death, but lots of other effects on their quality of life, how they mature. If they start using them too early, it has a dramatic impact in marijuana. Heavy marijuana use of medical level marijuana, which is much stronger than others, can take a toll on developmental aspects, both physically and mentally. We need to do a lot more education. DARE was a very good start to that. I don't know that it's as robust as it had been in the 80s. But then I also see on the other side of the coin, the administration sending what I believe to be counterproductive messages out to the public. Well, we know that everybody's using all these terrible, terrible drugs that affect your ability to work, your ability to mature, your ability to, you know, stay on an even keel. But we're going to, and people are dying. So the answer is, go keep using them. We're going to help you make it safe to use these bad, bad products. So we see these policies, I think, which are an offshoot of the clean needle exchange policies of the 1990s in places like Washington State and in other municipalities with more progressive looking social views, where now you have the administration giving out clean crack pipes, where you see the administration fostering a climate that encourages use of medical marijuana for non-medical reasons, for purely recreational reasons. You see the administration giving some test techniques to allow to test your illegal, dangerous opiate drugs for over lethal levels of fentanyl. To me, that's just the opposite of the messages that we've seen work so much with cigarettes. It's bad, it's bad, it's bad, it's bad, and we're not going to make it easy for you to smoke and not kill yourself. I just can't understand or reconcile the two different approaches.
That is a brilliant point. I want to return to that because I was watching, I used to love this guy. I don't watch him as much anymore, but my wife had had Bill Maher on like 2 weeks ago. He was saying exactly what you're saying as well. It's like, ladies and gentlemen, we are normalizing the usage of these dangerous drugs in our communities. And that is precisely the exact wrong message to send. I was speaking with Dr. Salvatore Giorgiani. He's coming to us from Florida, and it's a beautiful Thursday morning here across North America. We are going to take a quick break. This is TNT Deprogram. I'll be right back.
George Eliason on TNT Radio.
Today we have a special guest. This is a photojournalist from the UK. His name is Dean O'Brien, and Dean has had some very unique experiences. Makes him one of the most important journalists and photojournalists in the war in Donbass over the last 8 years. What were people telling you over there, Kramatorsk, Slavyansk?
Well, they were telling me kind of how they obviously can't practice their language. They have to be very careful what they say. When I was in Slavyansk, I was approached by somebody, and they said, "Oh, would you come and do a talk to our children at the school about you being a photographer?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure." And while I went and done the talk with the children, some of them kind of spoke to me afterwards and said, "You really need to go to the other side and see what the Ukrainians are doing to my grandmother's home." And they were referring to like the Donbass.
George Eliason on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
So many of your favorite libertarian celebrities are here at Freedom Fest. You not only get to hear them speak, you get to talk to them because our speakers are part of the action.
Freedom Fest is an amazing opportunity for freedom lovers from all over the world to meet and interact, to strategize and come up with ways to advance our principles both in the culture and within the political space.
Don't miss Freedom Fest, the largest liberty event of the year, July 13th to 16th at the Mirage in Las Vegas. For more information, go to freedomfest.com.
Freedom of speech, freedom of movement, freedom of choice, freedom of assembly, freedom of health. The voice of freedom is TNT Radio.
This is Deprogram. I'm your host, Michael Parker. I'm speaking with Dr. Sal, and he made an excellent point about the normalization of drug usage, which is a mixed message when compared to cigarettes. And it reminded me of an article that I covered on the air a week or two ago, and it regards Portland and Oregon. And Oregon was the first state in the U.S. to decriminalize the possession of personal use amounts of heroin, meth, LSD, oxycodone, and other drugs. Well, guess what? Portland has become like an open-air drug market, and their overdoses have gone up, unbelievably. It says, since the measure was passed, overdose deaths in the state hit an all-time high in 2021 with 1,069, which is a 41% increase from 2020. Doctor, your thoughts?
Well, it's very difficult to interpret statistics anywhere. Health, emotional wellness, mental wellness, abuse during the pandemic period, because it really is a social behavioral aberration, but it's an important one to understand because we will be faced with other public health emergencies of this kind in the future. So I think you need to understand them. But yeah, we have seen a dramatic increase in substance abuse, even appropriate, if you will, alcohol abuse during the period of the pandemic. And it's a reflection of the impact that mitigation or overly aggressive, overly prolonged mitigation approaches with no end in sight. I mean, uncertainty is a huge anxiety-producing factor in people's lives. So when you constantly hear the drone, well, we've got to be ready. There may be another surge. We may see more death. You know, it has a very disquieting effect. So I think it's a very troubling number. I don't know what the number in 2021 in Oregon would have looked like if it weren't layered into the pandemic scenario. But I suspect that the approach is just not a good approach. Normalizing aberrant behavior or behavior that's just not good for you or healthy for you with the goal of stopping deaths and allowing use of bad products just seems a poorly constructed way to do it. So again, you know, perhaps in Portland, if the focus had been on educating young folks about the dangers of it rather than sending the message, well, it's okay if you do it under these circumstances. I think that's, you know, a dilemma. That it almost is like the parent telling a child, it's okay to drink, but only when I'm watching you and only at home. Because sooner or later, you know, they're not going to be home forever,
right?
At least we hope not. And then that little bit of leniency turns into, in all too many people, abuse of alcohol. So I think you have to be very, very circumspect about mixed messaging and normalizing bad habits.
Yeah. I mean, I try to be sympathetic. I mean, listen, I'm not going to lie. I pretty much everything that's bad for me, I've tried at one point or another. And, you know, I love salt. I love red meat. I love coffee. I love a glass of wine. I have smoked cigarettes in the past. I'm not gonna lie. I've smoked pot. Anyway, I try to be sympathetic to all of these things. And I was initially, my libertarian side of my personality wanted, you know, some solutions that perhaps allowed for a more permissive approach to the, well, not, maybe not permissive, but just a sympathetic approach. And I just point to this thing in Portland as showing that, wow, well, okay, so that's not exactly working. So we're going to have to figure out. So there's not an easy answer. If there was an easy answer, we would have come to it already. But, yes. You know, so it has led to a breakdown of society. But one thing I do want to return to, because you made one about the cigarette thing, is you made a great point last night to me on the phone. Talk about the e-cigarette situation for a second and what you think about that as opposed to regular cigarettes, because as far as I could tell, they didn't really address that in this proclamation from the Biden administration. I don't know if they intend that for e-cigarettes or not. I guess they would, but I don't know for sure.
Well, I stand in a little bit of a small corner in the public health community in favoring the use of e-cigarettes as a substitute addiction. You know, e-cigarettes, you get nicotine. It's vaporized in water vapor, and it satisfies a nicotine craving. And you can actually adjust the nicotine levels so that you can, if you're really motivated to stop, because what you read about nicotine displeases you, its effect on the central nervous system, its effect on the gut to give you, you know, gastrointestinal problems, its effect on, in general, as a habituating, addicting substance. You just don't buy into that anymore. You get to a certain age and a certain life approach. But e-cigarettes, I think, have been vilified by the FDA and the administration. In fact, the FDA is getting ready to remove the ability for one company, one of the most popular companies, to sell electronic cigarettes of any kind on the market.
Really?
Yeah, Juul, J-U-U-L.
That's a huge company.
It is a huge company. And they said, well, we're going to do this to you because you advertise to kids and you advertised and you were driving up non-cigarette nicotine utilization in kids. Well, perhaps, I don't know. I'm not expert in that market dynamics, and that may be or maybe not true. I do think when you create nicotine-containing products that taste like bubble gum and cotton candy and blueberry pie, you're appealing to a certain segment of society. But instead of vilifying e-cigarettes, recognizing that they are a much safer substitute, it's not a terribly awful idea. And I know many patients, many people I've been dealing with over the decades, I've counseled on smoking cessation, including my wife, who have moved into e-cigarettes and then decreased their content of nicotine down to very, very low levels. And they are no longer have any cravings. those things work much better than patches, much better than gum, because they also satisfy the oral fixation needs, the oral habituation
precisely
that cigarette smokers have. So I don't think that they're all terrible. One, you might accuse me as well, Georgiana, you're talking out of two sides of your mouth. You don't want needle exchanges, and you don't want safe crack pipes, and you don't want a fentanyl limit test, but you're okay with e-cigarettes. I think there's a huge difference in those things, because one is a way to decrease the utilization of habituating substance that, generally speaking, is not good for you, but it's far, far a better approach than just banning it all. And I think that has to be considered as part of it, too. My wife went from being a two-pack smoker for almost 50 years to a zero-pack smoker and an e-cigarette user in a matter of a week, because she was motivated by the death of a very close friend from smoking cigarettes. So, you know, she had, now we traveled recently, and we were traveling in areas where you couldn't use e-cigarettes. She went without even an e-cigarette for almost 36 hours, which to me is remarkable that this also brought down not just her craving, her use of bad substance, a terribly bad substance, to an ability that she could control it much more carefully now.
I think that is an excellent point. And listen, I'm not a medical professional or a scientist, but it just makes sense to me that, listen, if you have an object that you're taking into your system that is on fire versus a water vapor, I mean, just that alone, the particulate matter that you're going to take in from the burning object versus a water vapor, that alone makes sense to me. And I remember, I believe it was fall of 2019, because you were talking about the villainizing of e-cigs. I remember at one point there was this sudden story that all these teenagers were developing these bronchial infections or what have you from e-cigs. This is speculation on my part, I admit, but I think that may have actually been COVID in the U.S. or some other kind of viral infection. I don't think it was actually the e-cigs. I don't know for sure, but that certainly was another kind of thing where they villain. I mean, I just put it out there. I remembered it, and I've heard a lot of people speak about it. And I, because I don't keep up with the e-cigarette story as much, I was not aware, but Juul, I mean, I don't even use e-cigs, and I know who Juul is, and Juul is a huge company. And I don't agree with this. I don't agree with the villainization of e-cigs.
Well, the other part of that story about men controlling the market is it's allowing two other companies that make e-cigarettes and these self-contained units that you buy to continue to market their product, because they're punishing. And I think there's a certain strategy here. Either you comply with our viewpoints on marketing and advertising, or we will destroy you, which is kind of a government approach to a lot of things, including healthcare. You comply with our mandates on vaccines, or you comply with our mandates on staying lockdowns, or we will, you know, hurt you, we'll harm you, we'll constrain you. I'm glad you brought up this business about the concerns that were raised about young people getting these terrible lung infiltrates, lung problems associated with inhaling bad substances. And it may have been COVID. I'm not so sure, because I think it kind of predated even the earliest notions of COVID. But what I do think it's reflective of the fact that These folks, they would use CBD products, which are oils you can disperse in these in the fluids that are used in e-cigarettes, and then inhale them. And some of that was illegal stuff. Some of it was black market stuff. Some of it was homemade brew, bathtub brew kind of stuff. But I think it was an attempt to, which still goes on, I know, to utilize these units as ways of inhaling cannabis. The dilemma that you face then was why were people using illegal cannabinoid containing substances in e-cigarette unit is because they prohibited them from being purchased on a free market and being controlled. Mm-hmm. So what? It's the same old story that goes back to forever. When government prohibits something, some people say, oh, yeah, well, I'm going to do it. Or the government makes you, they go, well, I'm not going to do it. So I think, you know, it's more than just good old American independence or a libertarian view of how I should live my life. I think it's just human psychology and marketplace factors that I think are badly interpreted by many bureaucrats. So, and you'll notice, by the way, once these illegal cannabis containing substances were cracked down on, the importation were cracked down, this problem just doesn't, you haven't heard anything about the numbers of deaths that were occurring. It was education. They loosened up the reins a little bit. They cracked down on, if we would do that with the fentanyl supply coming from China through Mexico, in these terrible drug cartels, you might have a much better success rate at limiting deaths or even injury from, you know, that horrible, horrible product, that as opposed to letting people know when it's safe to use a fentanyl-laced product.
It's extraordinary. And this article, the reason I wanted to talk about it is because if this were to occur, it would take quite a while to implement. And, you know, the tobacco industry has deep pockets, so they could fight back. You know, I'm not sure what happened, but I thought it brought up an interesting angle to discuss, because honestly, at the end of the day, I think it's more posturing than anything else. I don't know if it will happen, but so I wanted to get your thoughts on that. For the remainder of today's episode, because we have a little bit of time before the break and then we have the segment afterwards, you are an advocate for men's health, and June is Men's Health Month. So let's talk about that a little bit. Talk about the importance of Men's Health Month and what this all is about.
You know, I and my colleagues and friends and associates who are passionate about improving the health and the health awareness of boys and men, and how those who love them can help them get to better health. You know, we have a hard time sometimes persuading individuals that there is a crisis in men's health. And so two statistics I think we could probably get in before the break are the fact that men die much younger than women do over the past several years. I think part of it is the effect of COVID. The death longevity in men is now 5.7 years less than the longevity in women. When you match everything up and when you look at different racial groups and social groups, it's even more of a dramatic spread and disparity. That's actually up from what it was in 2019, when it was about 4.6 or 4.8 years discrepancy. So actually the lifespan of the American male has declined. It's terrible. Suicides in men and boys, there's four times the number of suicides that occur in men, and it's moving down in age. It used to be something we saw a lot of in post-65, but now it's moving down into the prime time years. Some people will actually say that the substance abuse is actually just a method of being suicidal, and some people have that theory. I don't think I agree 100%, but certainly it's plausible. So we see the suicide rate being four times that in men than in women. The other very staggering strategic statistic is that of the 10 leading causes of death in America, men lead in 9 of them by substantial amounts. The only exception is in Alzheimer's, where there's maybe a 2% difference between the death associated with Alzheimer's in men and women. So
I want to make sure I understand that, doctor. So you're saying of the 10 leading causes of death in the U.S., men lead in 9 of the 10, meaning that, it means what it means, but that's extraordinary.
Cardiovascular, cancer, pulmonary, violence, non-accidental violence, including suicides. Men have a much higher, statistically notable higher rate of occurrence of these by and large, preventable and or manageable conditions. And when you, another organization I work with is Healthy Men, Inc., which is a not-for-profit that's dedicated to helping create a more guy-friendly environment in healthcare, healthcare products, healthcare services. So Healthy Men, Inc. Is talking about the fact that men find healthcare the way it's delivered to them so unpleasant that they simply don't go.
I go to the doctor because my wife makes me, and I've got a couple of issues, but but by and large, you're right. Men don't like to go to the doctor. And we're coming up on the break, so we're going to take this quick break. I'm speaking with Dr. Sal Giorgiani. I always enjoy our conversations. And we have a mental health crisis in the United States, and it cuts across both sexes. But I think right now it's especially significant in men. And I think that contributes to some of the issues we're talking about. This is TNT Radio. We'll be right back.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
In this midterm election season, the establishment legacy media is very focused on what they call the big lie. To them, the big lie is not that COVID vaccines are safe and effective, or that NATO is fighting to save democracy in Ukraine. Oh no, the big lie to them is that Trump actually won the 2020 presidential election. For elections that have been called so far this primary season, 105 candidates who outright dispute the result of the 2020 election and 42 candidates who have questioned the results have won the Republican nomination out of 284 nominees in total. This means that 52% of the GOP nominees so far endorsed the so-called big lie in some way. But maybe it's the other way around, and there is evidence of widespread electoral fraud. I'll let you be the judge. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
A man's home is his castle, but his men's shed, that's his kingdom. There are now more than 1,000 men's sheds across Australia, and they're more than just a shed. You can make things, grow things, find a mate, be a mate, shoulder to shoulder. The Australian Men's Shed Association can help to find a shed near you.
There's something for you at the Men's Shed.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Black Lives Matter use of confrontation and violence has attracted criticism from other civil rights groups. Barbara Reynolds, a veteran of the 1960 civil rights movement, writes that many civil rights activists agree with BLM's goals, but fundamentally disagree with their approach. According to Reynolds, BLM uses confrontational and divisive tactics rather than proven protest methods. The BLM movement protesters have harassed presidential candidates, and critics argue it has become a movement concerned with instilling fear in politicians, white people, and police. BLM has been blamed for worsening race relations in America. Federal Bureau of Investigation has found that homicides of police officers have risen since 2014. And some observers identify Black Lives Matter protests as a contributing case to an anti-police environment. The FBI reported that perpetrators of attacks on police in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Dallas, Texas, stated they were influenced by the Black Lives Matter movement. Adding to the concern that BLM encourages anti-police violence are statements by BLM endorsing historical extreme-left anti-police terrorists.
For the news and talk you can't hear anywhere else, it's TNT Radio.
This is The Program. We're in our final segment with Dr. Sal Giorgiani, and we were talking about men's health. And I noticed that during the Men's Shed advertisement, you gave us the thumbs up on that. So Dr. Sal is aware of that. And we have, you know, our home base is in Australia. So if you want to speak to that, Dr. Sal, our folks in Australia would love to hear what you have to say about the Men's Shed.
Many of us in men's health advocate community love the concept of Men's Shed. There are some in the U.S. They've grown organically. We're looking to do things to help Men's Sheds grow in the United States. The Healthy Men, Inc., the organization I helped found, is very interested in that because it talks to the effectiveness of having an environment where men want to go to do guy kind of things, And it could be everything from cooking to building things to who knows what. But they're safe places for men to gather and then talk about whatever they want to. And they also layer in healthy messages or healthy lifestyle issues or talk about your health. It's almost analogous, Michael, to quilting bees that we knew of from long ago, where women get together and they would do things that women like to do then, quilt, but they would talk about everything. They would develop in many, many respects, something very important to helping address the emotional ill health of guys, allow them to have a group of trusted individuals in a trusted space where they can talk about their emotional concerns and get, very importantly, support networks that men, generally speaking, don't develop, particularly in the post-COVID world where we become very isolated, oriented. So I think men's sheds are a wonderful idea. I encourage individuals within their communities to look at the U.S. Men's Shed website and talk and think about how you can go ahead and develop those kinds of concepts as a way to support physical health, emotional health. And these guys also, they bring in younger men and teach them men-like things. It's not terrible. It's not a macho kind of thing. It's just things men tend to like to do because that's the way they're hardwired.
And mentorship and friendship and a sense of community is a good thing. And I agree with you. I mean, one of the saddest things about the COVID thing was the rise in deaths of despair of both men and women through, you know, alcohol abuse, substance abuse of all different kinds. And we're already very much involved with our phones and computers and screen time. And then, you know, we have to stay in our homes and all these things. It just got us away from being in touch with other people and men, especially because you were talking about men in healthcare. It's like most of us men, we kind of keep things to ourselves because that's really the way that we were brought up to be. I mean, I think it's different with the current young generation. They talk about their feelings more and every generation does a little bit more, but I think most guys in general, it's a coping mechanism that we have. Like as we mature, we keep more things to ourselves because we think it's a stoic sense of a show of strength. Well, I get that. The problem is now you're keeping everything inside, which can affect your emotional system, which then affects your digestive system and all these other things. So a sense of community, be it a men's shed, you know, even 12 steps, I think that's a big part of the reason that 12 steps programs work is actually the sense of community of people going in and seeing other people. I know that's probably a gross oversimplification in some people's minds, but I think that's a big part of the success is just being part of a community again.
Oh, for sure. Study after study after study after study shows that peer support groups are extremely important in helping people get through difficult health, life, or emotional conditions. I just did a listening session for the Autoimmune Society talking about men with autoimmune disease, such as Crohn's disease and other very, very difficult situations. There's a huge stigma associated with that for guys, particularly African-American Black men. And one fellow there at the listening session was very, very, made a very important point. I went to go find a peer support group for me when I found out I had this condition and I was struggling. And, you know, I wanted to talk with other people about it. And all I could find were groups of older women, none of them Black, who I just couldn't support. We also see in men's health that when you look at health promotion advertising, or health messaging in the public domain, and the media is greatly at fault for this, it's almost 75 or more percent geared towards women, where the guy is getting their advice from women rather than doing what is essential, taking their own responsibility for their own healthcare needs. That's that you've got to do that. Guys have to take a page out of the women's healthcare book and be responsible for their own health. But when you have media showing it's women's work, when advertising and health image messaging, even during COVID, most of the information about vaccinations, mitigation, et cetera, were driven with female imagery. When you look at the emotional screening for emotional illnesses in men and boys, there are no guidelines for boys and men. It's not done. 75% of those poor souls who committed suicide never ever had a diagnosis of a mental condition. Look at the problem we're seeing with mass killings. Some people believe that that is a form of self-punishment, suicide, and they're going to take some others with them. So, yes. You know, we have to address the issue of men's overall physical, emotional health much better than we're doing now. And it's not to paint everything pink. It's not just to take campaigns and programs that work well with women and put a picture of a guy or on there. But we have to look at the demographics. There are many, many individuals that identify as men who are biological men or have gender identification as men. We have to take into consideration the difference in sociocultural preferences and needs of Black, Chicano, Asian, white men in how they want their health care delivered and how they want their messaging. If we don't do that, Michael, I'm afraid we're going to see a terrible calamity of increased death rates from preventable and manageable causes in young men and in older guys like myself.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, medicine appears monolithic, and like most industries, it's slow to change, and especially when it's the medical industry, you know, it's like science. For a long time, it was untouchable. It's like, you know, you can't question this. And so I think the medical profession has become a little overly comfortable with its stature within our society. And when you mentioned the ways that men and women look at this, I laugh about my wife, you know, my wife and sister-in-law, they love to listen to the medical programming and medical shows. We have Sirius XM in the car. There's a doctor channel. She loves to listen to that. Guys, you know, we don't listen to that stuff as much. And so in the home, who's the sheriff when it comes to health? It's the wife. So I don't know what the medical community does or the medical profession does to extend its message to men. But I think one thing would be is try to be just a little bit less monolithic, man, and reach out a little bit. And it's also an uphill battle because guys, I don't think that we have the inherent interest in it that sometimes women do. That might sound sexist, and I don't mean it to. It's just what I've noticed in generally. So anyway, I know we're coming up on the end of the episode. We got a few more minutes. Dr. Sal, any more parting thoughts and anything else that you want to express to the audience today?
Yeah, there's a lot of information out there from good and valuable sources. Men's Health Network, one of the organizations I work with, I'm senior science advisor to that not-for-profit organization, has an awful lot of information out there, particularly for Men's Health Month in June. And then we're coming up with coming into Mental Health Awareness Month in September and Prostate Cancer Month. So, you know, there's a lot of information on the Men's Health Network website at www.menshealthnetwork.org. And also there's some interesting information coming on the other organization that I helped co-found, Healthy Men, Inc. at www.healthymen.org. So we're working, those two organizations and others are working to enlighten men, to help clinicians better understand how to communicate with men and create guy-friendly environments the way they did for women-friendly environments in healthcare in the 80s. And there is information out there, but it takes a lot of persuasion to get guys to overcome their hesitancy to engage in health.
Dr. Sal Giorgiani, I always enjoy talking to you. I'll look forward to the next time you're coming back on. I know you got a busy day ahead of you, so I'll let you get out of here. I'm coming up on the break. Anyway, thank you, Dr. Sal, and until next time. All right, folks, so we're coming up on the end of this hour. I'm going to be back in just a little bit. I want to remind you, if you're looking for me on social media, just, you know, I'm on most of them. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Parler. I'm on Gab. I'm on Minds. Michael Parker, LA. You can find me on all of those, and I would love to hear from you. Hit me up with your ideas for shows, for guests, for subjects that you want me to touch upon. And so I'm out there, just Michael Parker, LA. And so when we come back, we still have two more hours today. We're going to speak with Daniel Martinez, who's running as a Republican here in California, which ain't an easy feat. So he's going to be our guest on the other side. And then after that, we're going to have the filmmakers behind Bad Roads in the third hour. This is TNT. I'll be right back.